Five. Sorry for the delay. Okay, announcements for today. We are going to have experiment three. Doodle is up. Experiment three is going to focus on transfer function characterization for the same experimental platform that we've been using. We're going to model the controlled output transfer function, GVD, as we did in the previous section of the class, and then measure it experimentally. Talk a little bit about that in the next slide. Since we are pretty late on this, I'm going to do a couple of things to try to make sure this is a minimal burden. One is the write-up for this is going to be basically give you a template MATLAB code to plot your prediction and your experimental results. You have to turn in that and just comment on any discrepancy, what you think that could be. So that'll be the entirety of the write-up. Give me this plot with your measurement data and your model, and then if they're any different, tell me why you think that is. And then the other thing is I'll move homework 11 from this Friday to Monday, last day of class. Seem fair? Okay. Same deal on scheduling. There's a number of times there throughout the week. Sign up one person per group, and then you can go to 227 to complete the lab during whatever time you sign up for. Okay. The way this will work, it ended up being a bit small. So this is the same converter that we've been looking with on the top here. This demo board, same as experiment two. Here, we're going to be working with the next half of this system. So in experiment two, we worked with a converter that went from the PV panel to a battery. And we didn't actually implement that control because it requires some microprocessor, some algorithmic processing. But so that converter, its job is to do the maximum power point tracking. Okay, so it's going to be controlled, and the duty cycle is going to be set to whatever it needs to be. So it gets the maximum energy out of the panel and stores it in the battery. Okay. This converter would come after the battery. The input is that 8-volt battery and regulate a 5-volt output for USB charging of your electronics, charge your phone. So this one, the control goal is going to be to keep the output voltage constant at 5 volts. Previous one, the control goal was to do the maximum power point tracking. Okay. So to design that controller, as we've been looking at, what I'm going to do is design the compensator to shape the loop gain. In order to do that, I need to know what the controlled output transfer function is of the converter. So what we're going to do in this experiment is we're going to characterize that, and we're going to do so kind of point by point. And what I mean by that is, so we had the previous experiment, this PWM modulator, and we used a potentiometer, that slide, to change the duty cycle to whatever we needed it to be to get to the operating point that would provide maximum power. Here, instead of using that, so we're no longer going to use that slide, we're going to provide some voltage that establishes the duty cycle. So this V mod is going to be basically our control voltage. And then V mod over Vm will be the duty cycle, where Vm is that same thing we've looked at, the amplitude of the sawtooth wave internally. Okay. And what we're going to do is set this V mod to not just be some DC duty cycle that we want, but it's going to be the duty cycle that we want. Maybe 5 volts over 8 volts would be our DC value to get 5 volts output from 8 volts input in a buck converter. And then on top of that, we're going to do a small AC sinusoidal perturbation. And that small AC sinusoidal perturbation is going to result in a small sinusoidal perturbation on the output voltage. And then we look at that perturbation on the output voltage, compare it to the perturbation in the duty cycle through this PWM modulator. And by comparing those two, we can figure out what's the phase between them, what's the amplitude of each and the gain between them. That'll give us the gain and phase of GVD at a single frequency. And you'll test at multiple frequencies to characterize the entire Bode plot. Okay. So this down here would show what you'd measure at V out. V out is AC coupled on the scope. That'll just filter out the DC. And then what you'd get is some kind of AC sinusoid. Same thing in V mod. That's AC coupled. This is zero. Then I'd have some sinusoid here at my modulation voltage, some other sinusoid at my output voltage, and then I can look at the phase between them. For example, measure the time between one's peak and the other's peak, divide that by the total period, multiply by 2 pi. That would give me the phase and radians between these two. And then the amplitude of the perturbation on each. Here, the amplitude you'll set, function generator, and then you'll measure the amplitude on the output voltage. Divide these two, that'll give me the gain, and then time between them will tell me the phase. And what you'll eventually construct is, okay, at some frequency, omega x, I can measure the gain, GVD, by taking A out and A mod, I get some point. In the phase, GVD, I get some point. Then I change the frequency, get another point, change the frequency, get another point, then eventually characterize my entire Bode plot, compare it to my analytical prediction, maybe something like that. Hopefully they're right on top of each other. Does that make sense? Try to, again, I don't have the procedure posted yet. Almost, I'll get that posted today. But I try to, again, say step by step, do these things. Phase, I'll give the equation in the procedure, but basically the phase has to do with how these are shifted, right? You see on this top one, the peak is here, on the bottom one, it's here. So it's shifted a little bit, phase delayed a bit. Okay. So if you know the time between them, the time, I call this T phi, not the phase, it's the time. But then the phase is, okay, this time divided by the period is equal to phase in radians over 2 pi. Right. And I do it that way because then you're going to adjust the frequency, so the period is going to change. You'll have to do it with the corresponding whatever frequency you're measuring. Leave it somewhat up to you, but okay, if it looks like this, these points are fine. Hopefully you know the buck converter transfer function is going to look something more like this, some resonant Q. So you'll want to solve your transfer function first and then take points where a couple points out here is fine, but here you may need to make smaller steps in frequency as you're close to the Q so you can really get a good measurement of the shape of that resonant peaking. Okay. So take half a dozen to a dozen different frequencies enough to make sure that you've characterized exactly what this the shape of this transfer function looks like. Other questions? Okay, so keep in mind what this transfer function is. This is an AC linearization measuring small signal dynamics around a DC operating point. So we're only concerned with the AC part of these signals for the transfer function, but both of them will have significant DC. Okay. So V out will all be up at 5 volts, and then we'll just have 100 millivolts of this perturbation around that. Okay. Modulation voltage, it'll have some DC offset. That DC offset is going to correspond to the DC duty cycle, whatever's needed to get 5 volts at the output, and then have, I recommend 50 millivolts AC perturbation around that.
Okay.
So if you AC couple it'll delete the DC component out of it. Okay. What I recommend you do is don't change it to AC coupling until you've got it on and working. So see, look at the full signal in case anything goes wrong. And then once everything's on and running at 5 volts, change them to AC coupling. The reason for that is, particularly with the output voltage, it's 10 millivolts, and it's riding on top of a 5-volt DC. It's really hard to see it on the O-scope, because if you set the volts per div to 500 millivolts, you really can't see that 10 millivolts that well, and because of the 5 volts, it's off the screen. If you AC couple, it'll delete that DC, and then you can set the volts per div down to 10 millivolts and have a really big sinusoid and see it very well. I may ask that you take one waveform, but you don't need to capture them for every measurement. Just one representative waveform. As you're adjusting, keep in mind that you will have switching ripple around this. So the signal will look a little bit like this. That switching ripple should be in the hundreds of kilohertz range at the switching frequency. And the frequencies you're going to look at are going to go from DC to FS over 5, kind of the range of which we care about what this transfer function is. And we can't compensate anything above about FS over 5. But if you get your horizontal axis messed up on the scope, and I zoomed way too far in, but I'm just looking at this, what I might see is something in the output voltage that kind of looks like a sinusoid, but it's just the switching ripple. If you zoom too far in, you might misdiagnose that. Make sure that you're looking at frequencies that correspond to the frequencies you're setting with your function generator. And the procedural detail, there's a few settings on the scope you can do in addition to AC coupling, but at the high resolution mode, that'll help make these waveforms clearer. Other questions? Okay, so solve out GVD for the buck converter before you come in, so you know what you're expecting out of this. And then you'll come in, take these measurements, plot them. It's a little bit of a pain in MATLAB to plot a Bode plot with data on top of it, so I'll just have a MATLAB script that I put in there, replace GVD of S with your model for GVD of S, and replace the test data with your test data, then run it, and it'll plot everything for you. Okay. Other questions before we move on? Yeah, I forgot to do that. I'll do that today. I'll send those out. Okay. Nothing else. We'll move on with our magnetics. So last class, prior to Thanksgiving, we were talking about inductor design. We had gone through and applies Faraday's law and Ampere's law to solve the inductance of a gapless inductor here. We just have a closed loop of magnetic material and a winding around it. Used magnetic circuit analysis, noting the duals between electric and magnetic domain to analyze this, achieving the same result, solving the inductance of this gapless inductor. And then looked at saturation limitations, because this flux density is limited according to the material properties of whatever we use in the core. If we do saturate, the inductance drops down to the inductance as if the core wasn't there. It's a big problem. We noted that there are, in this gapless inductor, a few ways that we can increase the current that we can get to before we saturate. One was to increase saturation flux density, which is really just hope there's a better material out there. And the ones that we can kind of design around, the LM, the magnetizing path length. We can increase that number of turns, we can decrease, but both of those things will also decrease our inductance. If we want a given inductance at a given saturation current, neither of those are going to be viable options because we're sacrificing our inductance for saturation current. Then at the end of class, what we looked at is a gapped inductor, where we have this gap in the core that has only air in it, and analyzed this, found that Faraday's law does the same thing, Ampere's law. Now we have two different field intensities. We have an H in the core and an H in the gap. When we combine those together, what we get is an expression that looks like this, where V is equal to something times VIDT. That something is now our inductance with the gap. Okay. So we finished that. I'm going to begin today by re-deriving that same result using magnetic circuits. In the previous class, we did direct application of Faraday's and Ampere's law. Here, we'll just do it again using magnetic circuits. Okay. So similar to the ungapped inductor, what we're going to have is a circuit that has a biasing MMF source. S is equal to N I of T. This comes from Ampere's law, which tells us the MMF is the total enclosed current around some closed contour. We use a contour C, same as we did here. N I of T is equal to whatever this total MMF is, H times different lengths, but we don't need to worry about that when we're doing it using magnetic circuits. Have an MMF is N times I. So that's the coil biasing this. And out of the coil, we're going to have a flux phi. Out of the way. And that flux is then going to flow around this closed loop that goes through a bunch of the core and then a little bit of an air gap. And both the core material and the air gap are going to have some reluctance. We'll have two reluctance elements, reluctance of the core and reluctance of the gap. Each of these will be equal to length over permeability times area. The reluctance of the core will be of length LM, total magnetic path length, divided by mu AC. The reluctance of the gap will be length of the gap over mu naught AC. Mu being permeability of the core, mu not being permeability of free space. Okay. So in the magnetic domain, I can solve this circuit. It looks like B is equal to MMF over reluctance of the core plus reluctance of the gap. Plugging in, my flux is N I of T, the MMF, over these two reluctances that look like LM over mu AC plus LG over mu naught AC. Get back into the electric domain, I still have to apply Faraday's law. And he tells me that for some coil, voltage on my winding is going to be equal to N times DC DT. Equal to N times the derivative, plug in phi. As I do so, I'm going to multiply the top and bottom by area of the core, just to simplify a little bit. we get NACIFT over LM over mu plus LG over mu naught. Now I've got this derivative in time. My only thing that's time varying is the current. So I'll pull everything else out of the derivative front. And I'll get V of t is equal to n squared AC over LM over mu plus LG over mu naught times di of t dt. Where then this thing is my inductance. V is equal to L DIET. If I've made no mistake, N squared AC over this stuff should be the same thing we derived last time for the inductance. So L is N squared AC over LM over mu plus LG over mu naught. And then I'm going to an approximate expression for this. And I'm going to approximate this based on just some rough numbers for a general power inductor. Okay. So my LM might be about 1 millimeter. Oops, my LG, excuse me. My air gap, somewhere on the order of a millimeter or less, perhaps. My LM for reasonably sized core might be about 10 centimeters. And my mu might be about 10,000. These are numbers that would make sense for certain designs. Some designs we may have a much bigger air gap, much bigger magnetic path length, different mu, just kind of rough order of magnitude. Okay. If I have these numbers, I'm going to look at the denominator here. LM over mu is going to be 10 centimeters over 10,000. Too many zeros. And then LG over mu naught, my other term, is going to be equal to 0.1 centimeters over 1. I can multiply both denominators by 4 pi times 10 to the minus 4 to get the actual permeability, but it's going to make no difference. So what I'm going to conclude that 0.1 over 1 is 0.1, 10 over 10,000 is 0.001. So this thing is a lot bigger than this thing. If I take that and say LG over mu naught is much greater than LM over mu, look back at my original circuit, my reluctances are those two things just divided by AC. It's not going to change the ratio of them if I divide them both by the same thing. It's also telling me reluctance of the gap is much greater than reluctance of the core. So I can kind of simplify that original circuit and say really only the gap reluctance matters. So much bigger, and I've got these two resistances in series. I've got 100 ohms in series with 1 ohm. That's basically 100 ohms. Okay. So what does that do to my expression for the inductance? So if this term is much bigger than the LM over mu term, then it's going to dominate in the denominator, and I can neglect this LM over mu. Then this inductance becomes approximately N squared AC mu naught over LG. Which, under this approximation, which won't always be true, but for most kind of nominal designs will be, gives us kind of an interesting result. It means that the inductance doesn't depend at all on the permeability of the core. Now, that's subject to the permeability of the core has to be really high, but if that's true, I'm independent of that permeability. That, it turns out, is a pretty nice thing for some practical reasons that we haven't really discussed in detail, but this permeability for a given core material may vary with temperature and age, and it varies with the level of bias, how much flux I have going through it, which could cause my inductance to be kind of all over the place. Now, kind of to a first order, doesn't matter. The inductance is determined entirely by the air gap. As long as mu is large, if it goes from 10,000 to 20,000, it's not going to change my inductance. It's so big. Okay. That is subject to mu remaining big, which I'm going to need a material with a large permeability, which I'll normally use for cores. And so need large mu. Reasonably sized air gap, and I need to remain unsaturated. Once I saturate, this is all going to fall apart in any material, even if mu is 10,000. Once I saturate, it's going to drop to 1, and my inductance will drop significantly. Okay, so that's kind of a cool thing about gapping this inductor. I can remove any dependence on this core permeability. An even cooler thing, we'll talk about in the next slide. This just has a few of the equations we just used to derive the inductance, and also this equation for the saturation current, which came from exactly what we had here. Isat was Lm over mu n times Bsat in the ungapped inductor. The gapped inductor, we're going to have Isat is Lg over mu naught n times Bsat. And in terms of reluctances of the core, it's going to look like this. Making the approximation we had earlier, the reluctance of the gap is much greater than reluctance of the core. I can neglect the gap reluctance anywhere where it's added to the core reluctance. In all three of these places. And then I'll just plug in each of them. Reluctance of the gap is Lg over mu naught AC. If I plug that in here, I'll get N squared over Lg times mu naught AC is my inductance. And then my saturation current, I plug in. The ACs are going to cancel. I'll get Bsat Lg over mu naught N. Okay, this is great. Did everybody see why? Great, you're going to be impressed. Okay. So the problem in terms of saturation with the ungapped inductor was that as we changed things like the size of the inductor and the number of turns, we could increase the saturation current, but we would decrease the inductance proportionally. There's really nothing we can do if we want the same inductance at a higher saturation current. Now I have Saturation current depends on LG over N. Inductance depends on N squared over LG. One depends on a square, one doesn't, which means we're going to have some freedom to adjust things and independently set each of these. As an example, change colors. Let's say I have a design, all these things are set, NAC, LG, they're set, and I've got something that I'm okay with, but I want to alter it. So I try to double N and quadruple gap lengths. To do that, L, double N, N is squared, so I get a 4 in the numerator. I quadrupled LG, so I get a 4 in the denominator. L is the same. When I look down here at saturation current, doubled N, so 2 in the denominator, quadrupled LG, so 4 in the numerator. So I have ISAT is doubled. So I get the same inductance with twice the saturation current. Now, because of this difference in dependence, inductance and saturation current, I have some ability to change my design, get more saturation current without sacrificing my inductance. Eventually leads to is I've got kind of a two equation, two unknown system. I want to set inductance and saturation current, and I've got the number of turns and the length of the air gap. Didn't have that before when I had my ungapped inductor. All I had was number of turns. That was the only thing I could change for a given core. And as I go to different cores with different ACs, that also gives me a freedom. Okay. Sex of the air gap, decrease inductance. This is for the same core and number of turns. So if I just add an air gap without changing anything else about the inductor, I would decrease the inductance, but increase saturation current. And I have this nice inductance is not to a first order, at very least less dependent on core permeability. Mu, we talked about on the last slide. Okay. And really the big thing that's not said here is that the rate at which I decrease inductance and the rate at which I increase saturation current are different, which gives me some ability to, by also changing the number of turns, in addition to changing the air gap length, independently get the inductance I want and the saturation current I want. Yeah.
So you said the gap reluctance is way larger than core reluctance. So when you cross out...
I just crossed out the wrong one in each of those.
Yeah.
So I plugged in the gap reluctance when I actually rewrote these. Good catch, thank you. Cross out the other one, but all the equations, I did the thing I meant, not the thing I wrote. Do as I say, not as I do. Okay. So, how do we go about designing this thing? We're not going to probably get into that this lecture. We'll get into that next lecture. But okay, inductance is going to be something I have a value for. I'm going to design that from the analysis we did in the first section of the course, based on delta I or perhaps control or whatever. For my analysis, I'm going to tell I want this inductance. And then saturation current, we're not going to have a specific value that we want. We're going to have a minimum, right? Okay. In my normal operation, the current in this inductor is going to go up to 1 amp. So I just need my saturation current to be somewhere greater than 1 amp. probably put in some safety margin and say at least 1.5 amps. I'm not right on the boundary of saturation. But at this moment, I don't care whether it's 1.5 amps or 100 amps. It's not going to saturate. It's not going to saturate. So in order to really design this, we're going to have to consider more than just these two things. What's going to come into play is, what are the losses? Okay. So that 100 amp saturation current, I could get the really large number of turns. If I have a really large number of turns, I've got a really long coil. That's going to have a lot of resistance and a lot of losses that I don't need. Okay. So once we consider that resistance, like the next lecture, it'll give us kind of an optimal trade-off here on how to design the number of turns and the air gap length to get the inductance and the saturation current at least as high as we need it while minimizing resistance. Okay. Before we do that, I want to look at a couple more things while we're still in kind of magnetics analysis mode. I'm going to look at a transformer. In this case, I'm going to use an ungapped core, which is what we use in transformers that are non-energy storage elements. So basically all of the transformers we've looked at except for the flyback transformer, where I'm not trying to use that LM as my filter inductance, I would likely use an ungapped core. So can again analyze this either way, direct application of Faradays and amperes or magnetic circuits. In this case, magnetic circuits is going to be a little bit simpler, so I'll just do it that way. I look at this physical element, some core and two windings. In the magnetic circuit domain, that's going to look like a pair of MMF sources corresponding to each of the two windings. I have an MMF source F1, which is N1, I1 of T, and an MMF source F2, which is N2, I2 of T. Then in between them, my flux flows out of one through the other, back around. I'm going to have a single flux path. It's going to go through the core. So I'm going to see the reluctance of the core in between the two. That's my magnetic circuit model. As I analyze this, again, get is my flux is equal to 1 minus F2 over the reluctance of the core. And I've made a mistake in my application of Lenz's law. So these two sources should add. Because of the way I have these two windings, my right hand rule, this winding, my fingers trace the direction of the current going around like this, makes the flux go up. As I've defined I2 over here on the right, fingers are going to trace the direction of the current, which means the flux goes down. So both have flux flowing in the same direction. So these two sources should add, not subtract. The way I'd done it earlier would be if I defined I2 as coming out instead of going in. Okay. So here's my equation. I'm going to rewrite this and multiply the reluctance of the core over onto the left. The reluctance of the core times B is equal to the sum of these two MMFs. F1 is N1 I1 of T. F2 is N2, I2 of T. And then from this, I'm going to first analyze a case that is going to be my ideal transformer case in terms of what we have here. Making this thing ideal would be letting the permeability of the core go to infinity. So it is a perfect magnetic material that allows flux to flow through it with no reluctance. Reluctance of the core is Lm over mu ac. So letting mu go to infinity means that the reluctance of the core goes to zero. Because mu, again, as I say, not as I do, goes to zero because mu is in the denominator. If I set the reluctance of the core to zero, what I get is zero is equal to N1 I1 of t plus N2 I2 of t. That hopefully looks familiar. This is the current equation for an ideal transformer. Sum of the current in the windings times the number of turns in the windings is equal to zero. I can then apply Faraday's law to this. And give Mr. Faraday a capital F. V is equal to N dV dt. I can apply that on both windings. Say that V1 of t is equal to N1 times dV dt. V2 of t is equal to N2 dV dt. Where in applying Faraday's law, the voltage on a coil is equal to N times the derivative of the flux going through that coil. For this setup, the flux in each of them is the same. B for both coils, I have one flux and it flows through both of them, which means that I can set these two things equal. If I solve for dV dt, set both equations equal, divide N1 over, divide N2 over, what I'll get is V1 over N1 is equal to V2 over N2. That hopefully also looks familiar. Together, these two equations define something that as an electric circuit symbol would look like. This. Okay, that's my ideal case. Now let's look at the non-ideal case. So non-ideal, mu is finite. I don't assume the core permeability is infinite. Then what am I going to have? So I'll take maybe I won't. Come on, buddy. Oh, we're so close. All right, back. Okay. So V1 is equal to N1 dV dt, which is Faraday's law on the coil on the left. And then I'm going to plug in C is equal to N1 I1 plus N2 I2 over the reluctance of the core. Over the reluctance of the core, which is LM over mu AC. I'm going to factor all my constants out of the derivative, and I'm also going to pull out an N1 from the numerator, which is going to give me something that looks like N1 squared mu AC over LM times the derivative of I1, because I pulled out the N1, plus N2 over N1, I2 of T. Okay, following our process before, this looks like B is equal to something times the time derivative of some current. So this thing is going to be some kind of inductance. We're going to call it LM, the magnetizing inductance. The current it sees is I1 plus N2 over N1 I2 of T. Let's go back and look at starting from our ideal transformer. N1 to N2, this is I2, this is I1. If I, from the secondary, reflect I2 back through the transformer, it'll scale by N2 over N1. So I get a current here, Ix is equal to N2 over N1 I2. So the current I'm looking for, I1 plus N2 over N1 I2, the sum of these two things, which means there must be some kind of shunt path here. It's going to have an inductance LM. If I don't have this, these currents have to be the same thing, to be what we derived in the previous case for the ideal transformer. The real one, in addition to our ideal transformer, we get this magnetizing inductance. Back when we looked at isolated converters, I said, any real implementation, this is always there. And we need to be very careful that it doesn't saturate. Otherwise, we're going to try to make it really big and neglect it for most converters. Okay. So our LM is N1 squared mu AC over LM. That is magnetizing inductance reflected to the primary. I could have instead factored out N2, where I pulled out this N1, and what I would get is a magnetizing inductance on the secondary. That's N2 squared UAC over N1. I can push this thing to either side. It doesn't matter which side I draw it on. Either LM here or over here, it would be that same value times N2 squared over N1 squared that I reflect through the transformer. Either way I drive it, I'll get the same equivalent thing. Okay. So that's our transformer. Important thing to note here is that transformer saturation is generally an issue. We've talked about it. The difference in analyzing saturation of a transformer versus saturation of an inductor. We had an inductor. We said, okay, I can drive this ISAT. What's the current going through the inductor at which it'll saturate? I can do the same thing for a transformer, but it's going to tell me the magnetizing current at which it saturates. Only current through LM magnetizes or, say, increases core B of T. I1 and I2 do not. Inductor, I can define a saturation current that is the maximum current that can go through this inductor before it saturates. In a transformer, I can have as much winding current as I want, as long as no current is going through the magnetizing inductance. Okay. So more often than not, when we want to evaluate saturation in a transformer, we're going to use more general expression that we wrote before. 1 over N1AC times the integral of V1 of T dt. Or on the secondary, 1 over N2AC V2 of T dt. We can define a current, Isat, but it is Im sat. And that's equal to Lm over UN1Bsat. Has the exact same form as what we derived last class here. But the important thing is that this is a constraint on the magnetizing inductance, not the winding current. It's something that's very easy to get mixed up on. Okay, next class, we're going to look at kind of the B and H values of these different components in time, some general design, and then begin looking into different loss mechanisms in these magnetic devices and how to design them to minimize these. Okay. We'll pick up there Wednesday. I'll post these slides along with the doodle link at the beginning. So please schedule a time for experiment 3, one per group, and I'll post the solutions to homework 10.